Okay, we're back, Sam. Good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's going on?
You ready?
Anything happening?
Oh, nothing happened in the world, but you know, maybe there's some topics I can hit you with if you're okay with that.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. You've been concerned about Donald Trump due to his refusal of a peaceful transfer of power as a threat to democracy. But now we're beginning to see just how massive this Biden cover-up was. And in the past, we also saw Bernie pushed out by the Democratic elite in 2016. Aren't these also threats to our democracy? And maybe these aren't even threats. Aren't these actual moments where we didn't have democracy?
I mean, they're certainly a corruption of our democracy. I mean, they're not ideal. The details of, you know, what went into Biden running for a second term and just the level of delusion and hubris and dishonesty that birthed that project. I think that, you know, that was reading Jake's book, that was very troubling to discover just how deep that went and how unrepentant they all still are. I mean, we had an awful choice. We have, and it's a choice that I think explains how corrupt and corruptible the Democrats and the media were from essentially 2016 on. We had a choice between, I think, a genuinely evil candidate, right? I mean, certainly perceived to be evil by half of our society. I mean, I think, you know, this is, he's really is the banality of evil, because his evil is incredibly banal. But nonetheless, I think he's so outside the norm of what should be acceptable to us politically that it's easy to see that everyone perceived this as a 5-alarm fire. I mean, and we are now, I'll point out, living in the midst of that fire. We're 4 months into it.
Yeah, but you can't destroy or erode democracy while trying to protect it, right?
No, but I mean, it's not so clear as all that. It's just that you have to ask the questions. Why would anyone prefer a nearly comatose president to Donald Trump? Well, that's a measure of how bad people perceive Donald Trump to be. And I mean, I can say that I would prefer a comatose president to the president we now have.
That's slightly less than half the country feels that way. What about the other half?
Well, the other half is voting for Trump, right? So, and for reasons that are, in many cases, also delusional, right? I mean, you had a QAnon cult behind Trump who thought not that Biden was not only too old to be president, but that he was a pedophile, you know, and siphoning off the adrenochrome of children in basements. I mean, this is the fever swamp of right-wing politics that got Biden's infirmity right, okay? But look at everything else they threw against the wall, right? It's completely nuts over there. So, yes, the mainstream media has a lot to atone for in not being more interested in just how far from compos mentis Biden has been at various points, toward the end of his term and during the campaign. I mean, what I take from Jake's book, and I think this is one of the appropriate lessons to take from it, is that there was a successful cover-up. It's not that, I mean, everyone knew he was too old. I mean, certainly he was not an ideal president, or much less an ideal candidate. I mean, he was not actually a viable candidate in the end. And many of us saw that with increasing clarity over the years. But something was revealed that night on the debate stage when the wheels completely came off. And to say that we knew it all along is to make the claim that nothing was learned during that debate. And that's just not true, right? Maybe Alex Jones, who also thought Biden was a pedophile, also knew that he wasn't going to be able to complete a sentence during the debate. But most people thought this was...
I did reveal something. I don't think people felt like they learned it for the first time. I felt like they were watching that saying, okay, this is impossible to hide now. This is just no longer possible.
Well, yeah, no, but the magnitude of it, the gravity of it, the fact that it was non-recoverable, right? That was revealed that night to most people. Now, the scandal, the real scandal, is that there were undoubtedly people, and we know this from Jake and Alex's reporting in that book, undoubtedly, there were people close to the president who saw that sort of thing before, and many times before, going back years, right? That's the scandal. That's the cover-up. And that is a genuine cover-up, because they're hiding that. They're lying about that. They're protecting him from exposure so as to avoid any public viewing of that, right? He's not having cabinet meetings. He didn't have cabinet meetings for nearly a year. And the cabinet meetings he had prior to that were scripted. and weird, and the cabinet members are sworn to secrecy on some level to not talk about that. I mean, so that's the cover up. To say that there was no cover up and say this was all in plain view is just not true. It's just the fact that right of center, they were whinging about this for years, doesn't mean that there wasn't an effective cover up, because there obviously was.
There was effective cover up, but I think what happened was, I think a lot of people are claiming that they saw this all along. They were being convinced that what they were seeing with their own eyes wasn't the case. And not only that, they were being told they were being assholes for even pointing something like this out. And
yeah.
Again,
no, I think all of that's bad. That's obviously bad. But crucially, it was bad to the point of masochistic self-immolation for the Democrats, right? Like, it's not like it worked out well for the Democrats. It destroyed the Democratic chances for the presidency.
And beyond. I mean, the Democrats have a problem for a long time now.
So it's like the idea that this is, how much of this is intentional if it's synonymous with hitting a brick wall at 100 miles an hour, right? I mean, it's just, it was a disaster for the Democrats. So the Democrats screwed up. And I think the honest accounting of what happened there is that, like almost everything else we're complaining about in public these days, it was a coordination problem. I mean, that you had all these people who couldn't get on the same page about what this obvious slow motion train wreck, right? How could they get Biden to not be a candidate when he was adamant that he was fine to run for a second term? There's no good way to do it. They're all living in this hall of mirrors where the first person to express doubt about his viability is the first person to show disloyalty and will be fatally compromised in their career prospects thereafter, right? So it's an incentive structure that fucked everyone up. But it was not this calculated and effective deception. It was a pathological process. And everyone left of center should be unhappy about it.
But what happens now? What happens to those people, the advisors that were in charge?
Well, I mean, as I wrote after the debate, when he was being slow to drop out of the race, I wrote this in one of those articles on Substack that were increasingly shrill. I said, but if he's not out of the race by Monday, I think it was the day I called, all we're going to want to know are the names of the people who have enabled this atrocity so that they'll never work in politics again. Right? I don't think these people should ever work in politics again. I mean, it's a disaster. The people who covered for Biden, the people who thought he should run even after that debate, should never work in politics again. They have discredited themselves fatally. That's absolutely the case. And you read about them in Jake's book. It's mind-boggling, the level of self-deception that's expressed in that book.
Yeah, I mean, I find it, I'm embarrassed, I'm humiliated by it. I mean, the amount of times I've had to, lean on CNN to explain something that, where they helped me. I obviously seen with my own eyes and being told, guys, it's, there are people that are talking. And I guess my point with Jake is that he could have been a little bit more of an intrepid journalist and asked more of the questions. I know he said, I wish I would have done that more, but I feel betrayed. I feel like I relied on many of those sources to get this information and get it right. And again, when I saw it with my own eyes,
but you have to, I mean, I it's true. I mean, I think there's enough embarrassment to go around in the mainstream media, but it is also true that Biden was effectively hidden to a degree that is unprecedented.
But why aren't you asking every single day, where is he? Where is he? Where is his cognitive test? Where is the man? If that were Trump, they would have done that every single day. They would have said every day,
where is he? I think some of that was happening. I mean, I remember whenever there was something important for the president to communicate about, and he wasn't communicating about it. I mean, post October 7th, there were many moments when we needed a president who could come forward and make the case for why the U.S. was standing with Israel in the conflict with Hamas. And we did not have, I think he made some attempts at communicating about that, but it was clear that his deficits as a communicator were actually causing problems for society at that point. And I think I said as much in some context, probably on my own podcast. I mean, it's the separation between the two parts of the job, the decision-making component of the job and the communication/persuasion component of the job. Yes, the decision-making component of the job is important. And I think, as I said when I was talking to Jake, and as I said, I think some years before when we were all talking about Biden being compromised, it's at least intelligible to say, okay, he's not a good communicator. He was never a good communicator. He's only getting worse, right? You can't reliably stick him in front of a microphone and trust that something good is going to come out of his mouth. But the truth is that when you sit with him and deliberate about the war, you know, war in Ukraine or anything else, he is compos mentis. He clearly understands the issue as well as he ever did. He's just not a fluid speaker, right? And less and less fluid by the hour, right? That is a, neurologically speaking, that is an intelligible claim to make about a person. That's what I assumed was true. That because of how effective this cover-up was, I no longer believe that to have been true, right? I think it's quite possible that he was just checked out to a degree that I did not suspect at the time. But to close the loop on this whole scandal, even that is preferable to me and to, I think, many Democrats than having someone who we consider to be genuinely evil, genuinely 100% purposed to serving himself in the office of the presidency. I would rather have a president in a coma where the duties of the presidency are executed by a committee of just normal people, right?
But that would be different if
people
they communicated.
People picked at random out of a Starbucks, I would prefer to an evil president. And that's the choice that many of us believe was before us. And so therefore, not much materially changes once you reveal just how insane and despicable this cover-up of Biden's infirmities actually was.
But Sam, but how you get there matters. And it would be one thing if those people told the American people, hey, he's not compos mentis. We're going to take it from here. Yeah. We know what we're doing. We're fine. But that didn't happen. And I mean, just the scale of things, Trump's out there making hotel deals. And I know that's embarrassing. And this is a bit of a Sophie's choice, but you really would rather not have been betrayed by your own president than have somebody out in the open just, you know, with his kleptocracy, getting he and his friends rich?
No, but the problem with Trump runs much deeper than that. I mean, that is totally disqualifying in a president. It's illegal. I think it is the very definition of unconstitutional, given the Emoluments Clause. I think he should be impeached for it, right? I mean, I don't have an expectation that he will be, but the liability of having Trump in the White House, in my view, runs much, much deeper than that. And there's probably 100 hours of me talking about this on my podcast and others. I think to have an empty Oval Office would be better. I mean, and that's to say that there's lots of other normal career politicians who have been deputized in the State Department and other, you know, parts of the executive branch to make normal decisions, you know, that are not thinking about their hotel deals and their meme coin. I mean, that it's normal politics. The swamp. I would return to the so-called swamp over what we have now, and for good reason, right? And that was always that's been obvious for now 10 years, right? So all the problems with Hillary Clinton, all the problems with Kamala Harris, you know, I've never been shy to acknowledge those, right? All the problems with the Democratic machine as it is, yes, it screwed Bernie Sanders, you know, all of that, price all of that in. I think it is worse to have a president who values nothing but loyalty in the people he appoints to run our government. I mean, the fact that we've got Kash Patel running the FBI, and the FBI is now weaponized against private citizens who are being, quote, investigated and thereby bankrupted simply because they were against President Trump at some point in the past. You know, that's the road to fascism, right? That's much worse than having normal people pulled out of a Starbucks who would be appropriately awed by the responsibility given to them run the country.
Yeah. I just want to take a quick comedy break when you said Kash Patel. Did you see that video with he and Dan Bongino having to defend that Epstein himself?
No.
You didn't see it?
No,
oh,
I missed it.
Oh, you got to see it. They basically
and horror, no doubt.
Well, they're now on the other side having to defend themselves from the conspiracy theorists. They're literally saying things like, look, I know a suicide when I see one.
Oh, really? Suicide. Well, that's delicious.
Oh, both nice. He and Dan Bongino. Oh,
that's fantastic.
It's happy watching.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry I derailed this, but I want to get back to it because there's just something we talked about last time where I said this last time, there's something more off-putting and gross to me about lying and in secrecy than there is out in the open. And I know that's probably more of an irrational, an emotional thought than irrational.
But it's not all out in the open. there's a lot out in the open, and there's and you have to imagine that that's the tip of the iceberg of corruption, right? To grade Trump on a curve so fully that the visibility of his sins are exculpatory, right, is just pure delusion, right? You have no idea what you don't know about what he's into. And we know, we already know he lies more than any other person that can be named, right, anywhere in public life. So the idea that he's not covering anything up is just doesn't fly.
Again, I mean, the Trump lies to me, I don't know why, and you, we'll have to understand this or get some psychologist of some or sociologist or someone to explain this, but it just feels like when he's called, it says he's got a building that's 20 stories tall and it's only 10. I just don't really care. Or some of the other lies, they just feel, of course it's corrupt to be both the policymaker and the deal maker.
He deports someone to a torture room in El Salvador and then laughs about it at the Oval Office and says he can't get him back, right?
Yeah, I'm not defending that.
That's a lie. It's a lie that he can't get him back. He can get him back in an hour, right? It's a sociopathic level of detachment from the real suffering he's causing, admitting that this person was sent in error to El Salvador, and admitting that the process was so haphazard that we've probably sent 50 people who we really don't know whether they're innocent or guilty in the first place because there was no due process. I mean, there's just layers of this, the layers of the damage done to our society, to our system, the way we've edged toward fascism just by throwing due process out the window. All of that's an unacknowledged harm.
Yeah, okay, but the damage to our system, you're right. The big lie was terrible. The big lie was about one person lying about becoming president versus the Biden lie, which is a person lying about being president. That's a big problem.
But again, you have to acknowledge the clarity and obvious malice of the first lie and the ambiguity and the kind of the slow-rolling nature of the other lie. I mean, okay, Biden is probably not well-placed to understand his deficits because he's the one with the deficits, right? I mean, this is just the classic case of somebody for obvious reasons not wanting to admit that they're no longer competent to drive anymore. And now you have to have the conversation with them that they're, you know, it's time to take the keys from them for the rest of their lives, right? That's, you know, a famously hard negotiation for most people with their parents. And, you know, it's completely understandable that there's a lot of self-serving bias and delusion creeping in on the side of the person who thinks that, no, nothing much has changed and I can still drive, right? So that's...
But Sam, it's the same thing you're talking about. This is the president of the United States. And I know you're not talking about Biden himself. And I know you're going to go into, well, it's the people around him. But this is a grave sin. This is a big problem that it's not just like grandpa taking away the keys. This is the country.
But there's no bright line. It's not a lie that has a bright line. Because if you see him...
What do you mean a bright line? Everyone could see it. Everyone could see it, and people around
everyone could see it on the debate stage.
Okay, but it was, I don't know. But it was enough what we saw. That the excuses we made was enough that we saw that we should have said, okay, this guy's probably not at his best.
So it was absolutely obvious to me that after that debate, what should have happened is that he should have resigned and handed the presidency to Kamala Harris, right? And then she should have campaigned as president for a few months. That would have been, just from a purely pragmatic, you know, political campaign point of view, better for her. She would have been much more likely to win.
Yeah, but you got to roll the clock way back.
No, but also just to make this point clear, it was illogical to concede that he's no longer fit to campaign, but then to overlook the fact that that called his capacity to govern into question, right? I mean, like, if he can't campaign, why do you think he can actually be president? Right. And again, there's some distance between communication and deciding there, but not so much as to have made his presidency seem viable at that point. So I think he should have resigned. And many people thought that. But the question is, as you think about his unraveling over the years, it's very easy to see that the people who have limited exposure to him. Now, what the five people who had full-time exposure to him were doing, that's another story, right? I mean, just how much dysfunction did they see? How many days a week was he like he was on the debate stage? But for those who saw him sporadically, his cabinet members didn't see him for a year, right?
Yeah, but that right there should have been the alarm. The bell should have been ringing nonstop.
we have very few mechanisms by which to pull the brakes on our democracy.
We have the media. Any one of them could have gone on Jake's show and said, okay, Jake, I haven't talked to the president in 9 months.
And they know, and then they never work in politics again, right?
Okay, but are you integrity or not? Isn't, what's her name? Liz Cheney, your hero?
But yeah. No, but okay. Granted that those are failures of integrity in certain cases. We can attach a scandal to that, right? But the scandal on the Republican side, the mirror image on the Republican side, is a thousandfold worse. What Republicans are not saying, have not been saying for now a decade, honestly, about Trump, what they will say in private, but they will not say in public, right, is a scandal, the immensity of which we will, you know, it'll take generations to appreciate, right? We know that there are Republicans who are in fear for their lives to speak honestly in public about Donald Trump, right? There's nothing like that going on in the Biden universe, as corrupt and self-serving as it is. There's no comparison between the two. There still isn't.
But we still don't know the depths of the lies. I mean, I understand. I mean, you can call it a thousandfold or whatever it is. A lie is a lie. And it does feel to me, I still feel maybe I'm handicapping my expectations here for ethics, but I feel really betrayed. I really feel betrayed by what just occurred.
Yeah, but most of us who appreciate just how dangerous and incompetent Trump and Trumpism is.
But I agree with you.
Feel betrayed because of how ineffective, I mean, in addition to everything else that is awful about how the Democrats have behaved in recent years, all of the moral panic of wokeness that deranged everything, right, and made everything more difficult and just pointlessly horrible. One of the things, the thing that was worst about all of that is that it has given us Trump. I mean, I blame the Democrats as much or more than I blame the Republicans. I will admit that there's something perverse about this, but what is bad about all of that is how ineffective it has been politically, how ineffective it has been with respect to governance, and therefore how it has delivered us into the hands of Trumpist lunacy, right? And I'm not quite as far toward the brink as someone like Timothy Snyder, but I take people like Timothy Snyder seriously when they say that we're on the cusp of losing our democracy with Trump and Trumpism, right? I think that you cannot dismiss that as just, you know, pure paranoia at this point. I mean, what's happened in the last 4 months has been terrible, both domestically and internationally. And in terms of the perception of it and discussion of it, right of center, it's pure self-serving delusion and lies that are much worse than anything reported in Tapper's book about Biden.
I mean, look, I get it. I think just to go back to what you said about, look, I find Trump worrisome.
We have a president who's taking bribes from a regime that funds terrorists.
Yeah, I get it. I'm with you on all that. But I worry more about, you know, the fact that Trump is now, the right has captured the working class from the Dems. I don't know what the Democrats are going to do. I worry. I don't know what their plan is to go forward from here. I don't.
Well, the Republicans are on the verge of alienating the working class. And this is, we have this from the Oracle, Steve Bannon, based on the degree which they're poised to pander to the oligarchs and the other rich people who want tax cuts, right? So if we deliver tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans and continue to run up the debt and make some cuts to Medicaid, maybe in the to not run up the debt quite so high, this is according to Bannon as of I think today, that's a good way to lose the working class.
So that's the plan for the Dems, the just wait for Trump to step in it and lose the working class? Or
I just think to imagine that Trump has a secure purchase on the working class, I think is, it may in fact not be the case. You know, I mean, the Dems obviously should, I'm concerned about wealth inequality and I would want a Democratic candidate for the presidency to take that as a plank of the platform that is worth focusing on. Right. I mean, obviously we have a problem there, but it's not the only problem we have. And, the Republicans certainly don't have a solution for it. We're not going to, burning clean coal and trying to onshore our manufacturing base so that we can make, $4,000 iPhones here is just not a path to that.
Yeah. I just want to go back to Jake for 1 second since I'm a manager. And you know, I view it through this lens. I really wish he didn't write a book. I don't know why he did a book. And why not just go on CNN, where he had been in that seat for many years, telling us, you know, getting it wrong. Why not go sit in that chair and now get it right and just report the news, right? Why go on a book tour? You don't really get to be the guy that breaks into Watergate or helps break into Watergate in some way, and then, you know, tour the country as Woodward and Bernstein. And again, I'm a fan of Jake's. I actually commend him for going on this tour of getting paddled for the last week now.
Well, writing a book is just a different kind of reporting, right? I mean, you're just going much deeper. You're taking the time to actually, I mean, they did 200 interviews, I think, or over 200 interviews for this book. It's just that, you know,
But he could have taken that information and sat down for an hour and said, listen, I want to talk to the American people. This has been going on for the last few years.
Well, yeah,
I
got this wrong. The thing that is corrupt and corrupting about the publishing business is to hold information until your pub date. Right. That is incompatible with journalism. And I've seen many other journalists have done that. I mean, you know, I think Bob Woodward did that. He had some, I forget what the scoop he was that he had, but he dropped something, you know, once his book was safely published that he had clearly held on to for, I think the usual calendar was probably ramped up in his case, but I think he had probably held on to it for at least 6 months. The usual time course is about 11 months between when you finish a book and when it's published. Yeah, I mean, that is, for a normal writer, you know, who's just, you know, what all that person does is write books, it's natural to not blab about what's in your book until it's there to be bought. But even, I mean, you know, pre-sales are sales. So, I mean, even that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think if you have information that is politically relevant, is relevant to know sooner, and journalistically relevant, and you happen to be a journalist, yeah, I don't think you can justify not talking about that thing, waiting for your book tour to start. I agree with that.
Okay, Sam, I want to jump to another subject. You get a lot of feedback in the form of comments all over the internet. And I have to say, there was one email I read this week that impressed many of us over here. It was a sort of masterclass on how to respectfully disagree with someone. And his argument was laid out beautifully. He also represents a sizable cohort in your audience who disagrees with you about Israel's actions in Gaza. And I just want to say before I read some of it, there's obviously a very complicated issue, and there's been some unfortunate lies that have made being Jewish in America very unsafe these days, including the recent lie that came to us from the UN that 14,000 babies would die in the next 48 hours in Gaza, that was later retracted to state that 14,000 women would become malnourished within a year if things didn't change. I can't say that that lie got two Israeli embassy staffers killed this week, but it certainly didn't help. Seems that too many people are struggling to separate the Jewish people from the Israeli government policy, just like obviously nobody should be gunning down Chinese people for the Chinese government's policies, and the same should be true for the Jews. So I'm going to get to this email. I'm just going to read it. Here's a bit of it, but really impressive.
Yeah, it was a great email.
Hi, Sam. I'm a longtime subscriber to your meditation app and podcast, and I've always appreciated your willingness to take on difficult topics with intellectual honesty. I may be misunderstanding parts of your argument, but this is how your recent commentary has landed with me, and I wanted to share my honest reflections in the spirit of open dialogue. Since the Israel-Gaza war began, I've tried to keep an open mind. The October 7 attacks were horrific. Listening to survivors' testimonies, including those you've shared on your podcast, made that clear. I absolutely believe Israel is justified in protecting its citizens and in taking action against Hamas. There's no doubt that Hamas is a theocratic and genocidal group that cannot be negotiated with, and I share your concern about the dangers of Islamic extremism as a kind of mind virus. But as the war has gone on, I found the scale of suffering and death in Gaza increasingly difficult to reconcile with self-defense. The images, the testimonies, the destruction, whatever one's view of the moral landscape, the humanitarian toll has become staggering. The takeaway I've had from your view on this is that ultimately the number of Palestinian civilian deaths doesn't matter as long as Israel is kept safe, and that given the ideological saturation of Gaza, those lives were already compromised. That's a line I can't cross. I've also found the recent episode with David Deutsch troubling in this regard. The section on anti-Semitism seemed to me like an attempt at an intellectual sleight of hand, shifting the conversation away from legitimate criticism of Israel's actions in Gaza toward a broader cultural diagnosis of anti-Semitism. While I absolutely agree that anti-Semitism is real and dangerous, it felt as though this framing preemptively discredits any moral objection to what is happening in Gaza by suggesting it may be motivated by bigotry. That risks shutting down honest discourse, especially from people who are horrified by both Hamas and the current scale of civilian suffering. I don't claim to have an answer. The two-state solution feels almost impossible when one party is committed to your destruction. But I do think there's a blind spot here, a kind of moral tunnel vision. I know you're brilliant, and I expect you'll be able to make a clever, internal, consistent argument in response. But reality on the ground has now overtaken the moral calculus of October 7th. That doesn't excuse Hamas. It doesn't deny Israel's right to exist, but it does raise profound questions about what we're willing to accept as necessary collateral damage. I don't have a horse in this race. I just want the killing to stop. I remain a supporter of your work, and I'll continue listening. I've heard you say many times that no one is right about everything. I hope you can take this message in that spirit. Kind regards, Andrew Hughes. And I got his permission to read that, but quite an email.
Yeah, well, the first thing to say is just how gratifying it is to discover, again, I mean, this is, we've made this discovery many, many times, just how many smart, insightful people are in the audience. Okay, so I mean, just there's a few things that I think I should say to just kind of bound the discussion. I mean, just to make it clear how I think about these things ethically. If there were no difference between Hamas and the IDF, right, and if there were no difference between what most Palestinians want and what most Israelis want, or what most Jews want, if those differences didn't exist, then it wouldn't matter who won, right? It wouldn't matter what, you know, who was coming across the border, in which direction. I wouldn't take either side. They'd be the same people to me, right? So there really, in my view, there really is no tribalism. And the fact that I happen to be ethnically Jewish is distracting for some people in the audience, I understand. But honestly, in my view, I think it has no role to play. I mean, though there's other ways I put this in the past. I said, you know, if I mean, I feel exactly the same way about October 7th and what happened to the Israelis there, as I felt about the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris and what happened to the French journalist there. I'm not French, you know, I'm not identified in any way with being a French journalist, but that hit me in exactly the same way and for the same reasons, right? So if you're going to allege tribalism as being somehow responsible for my blind spot, I really do think my so-called blind spot, I think you're missing, you're just not making contact with who I am or how I think about these things. So the fact that there is a difference between Hamas and the IDF, and I, you know, I've spent decades spelling out what this difference amounts to, the fact that there is a difference between what most Palestinians really want, right, and what most Jews and Israelis really want, right? There's a cultural difference. There's a, on the one side, there really is widespread support for a death cult. There really is widespread belief in martyrdom. There really is widespread jubilation at the pointless destruction of innocent life, civilian life. And on the other side, there isn't. There simply isn't. You do not find the celebration of the taking of women and children and even infants as hostages in Tel Aviv that you found in Gaza, right? There, all kinds of things are normalized in Palestinian culture that are not, that haven't been normalized for as long as we've been alive in Jewish culture or in Israel. All those differences matter, and if those differences didn't exist, I would not pick a side in this conflict. So insofar as you can point out that there are religious fanatics on the Jewish side, right, who make any kind of distinction between the two sides increasingly inconvenient. You know, you can stick a microphone in front of some ultra-Orthodox lunatic and get him to make noises that are at all similar to those of a jihadist, right? Insofar as that happens more and more, it's going to make it harder to make this distinction, right? So it's, and I will admit that there are religious maniacs on the Israeli side. They are far less representative of, again, what most Israelis want and what most Jews want, then Hamas is representative of the Palestinians. It's just that you cannot, there's no straight equation there. If there were a straight equation, I would not care about the two sides. I mean, they would deserve each other, right? So all these differences matter, and these differences, again, are part of a much larger contest that I have been worried about for decades between open societies and their enemies in the Muslim world, right? And the enemies are jihadists above all, but also Islamists, and to some degree that is very difficult to talk about and, you know, quite inflammatory to name, just mainstream conservative Muslims, right? Islam, the fundamentals of Islam are also a problem most of the time, much of the time, for open societies, right? For the rights of women, say. Women are not the political equals of men under Islam, right? That's not jihadism. That's not even just Islamism. That is Islam, right? Islam needs a reformation on that point. And so this is a much wider issue where I view Israel to just be the most difficult case of the conflict between 7th century Islam and modernity. And I'm picking modernity over the barbarians at the gates, right? And if you think it's propagandistic to call Hamas barbarians, you don't understand what Israel or the rest of the world is dealing with jihadists. The other point I'll make is that the fact that so many people find the suffering in Gaza, the undeniable suffering in Gaza, so excruciating is totally understandable. I share those ethical intuitions. And yet we should also acknowledge how the social media and the media is being played by activists and liars and partisans, right? I mean, it should be interesting to you, for everyone who's worried about Gaza. I mean, it takes someone like Theo Vaughn, the podcaster, yeah, comedian whose clip just went viral, calling what was happening in Gaza a genocide. You know, Theo admits that he doesn't know what's going on over there. He's not well informed, but the images convince him that this is just intolerable. Again, totally understandable. What is interesting, what should be interesting, and the question for which there is a ready answer is, why isn't Theo thinking that about Sudan, right? Why isn't the suffering of the Sudanese, who are being immiserated at much greater scale, right, in precisely the same time period, right? I mean, the most recent civil war in Sudan started in 2023. I think it's April 2023.
Yeah, not to sidetrack you, but it's probably because Israel's, unless I'm missing, you know, not paying attention, I don't know how many other democratically led countries are doing something like this in 2025.
That's not the reason. The reason is not that there's a democracy involved. I mean, it's...
Well, I understand the propaganda from Qatar and all those, you know, hundreds of thousands of social media accounts that are flooding with this propaganda.
This is the point that does link up with anti-Semitism and with David Deutsch's view of it. The reason that Israel is this bright, shiny object among nations and has been for as long as we've been alive, is not explained by how badly behaved Israel has been or by how politically corrupt Israel has been. I mean, there's a lot to say about Netanyahu that is troublesome, right? I mean, in my view, there's a very straight analogy to make between Netanyahu and Trump as, you know, the style of politician that he is. But that doesn't explain the focus on Israel, right? And the lack of focus on all of these other regimes that are far worse in every respect, right? And in a contemporaneous way, are piling up the bodies at much greater scale, right? The same sorts of bodies, just women and children, Muslim women and children, right? In the case of Sudan, you know, or in Yemen, right? Or Syria, right? Again, if you were not concerned about what was happening in Syria, if you're not concerned, to close the loop on that point, which again, I think is a completely specious point that, you know, Noam Chomsky has been trotting out for 50 years, that it has to do with our culpability for our government, that's really the concern. That's just not people's concern. They're thinking about the death and suffering. They're not thinking about who made the bombs. But if you care about who made the bombs, right? We sold the bombs to Saudi Arabia that they used to kill hundreds of thousands of Yemeni women and children. Why didn't you care about that? Why weren't you being endlessly propagandized with imagery of that on social media? There are answers to that question. And
right, but we're here. We're here. We are propagandized by it. And so we are seeing it. And I think what he's talking about...
Well, you have to correct for that. Then you have to care about Sudan. You have to care about Yemen.
Okay, so we can go on that mission and get people to try to do that. And I think, I mean, when I watched Theo Vaughn in that video, and again, he says he's not educated on it, and I feel, you know, it was a mistake, I think, to use the word genocide. He just doesn't know, but you can feel his heart breaking. He's obviously...
Yeah, but it's more than a mistake. It is to succumb to a calculated piece of propaganda. Again, the scale of death, you have to compare it to, one, the alternatives, right? And you have to honestly acknowledge what the situation is. The situation that Israel faces is totally unprecedented. They have a suicidal and genocidal enemy that views the death of its own non-combatants as further signs of its own victory. Who has faced an enemy like this, where you kill its own women and children, however inadvertently, and that is part of their plan? They have built tunnels under hospitals and schools and mosques for the purpose of making it impossible to kill them unless you kill their non-combatants, and they kill their own non-combatants when they try to escape. So this is not a situation that anyone has faced, and insofar as we have faced it, and we, in this case America, fighting jihadists in the Middle East, we have also killed lots of non-combatants, and there was not this same outrage. Right? Okay, there was some outrage, but you didn't see the protest on campuses. And
well, we've all learned, and here we are. And my question is, you know, at what point do you say, okay, Israel has killed too many Palestinian civilians?
You're not describing a learning curve. We have not all learned, right? The next time, 2 weeks ago, we killed, I think, 68 non-combatants in a bombing of the Houthis, right? This got memory hold in 15 minutes in the news cycle that can't get enough of the, quote, atrocities and genocide in Gaza. We have not learned, this is not like we have suddenly become so ethically scrupulous that this kind of death and destruction is intolerable to us. No, it's just when Israel does it, right? Again, we did it. The Americans did it 2 weeks ago.
I didn't even know about it.
Yeah, you didn't know about it because nobody fucking cares. And there's a reason, because we only care about Israel doing it. And so there's something to explain about that. And anti-Semitism is part of it. It's not the only part of it, but it's also just that you have on social media, you know, coming from, you have a very organized campaign, a funded campaign, coming from the Muslim world, and it's not just them, but I think Russia is also, historically, Russia has been involved in this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Let me grant you everything you're saying. There's a propaganda war. There's all of this is happening. It's different, but there's still a scale problem here. And I understand Israel's up against everything. Believe me, I know it intimately. I know it well, and it concerns me greatly. But is there a point in which we say, okay, we're going to have to rethink this because this isn't working. There's too many deaths.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, that question could have been asked and was asked by many people at every stage along the way. I mean, I remember being skeptical about them going into Gaza in the first place. I mean, it's not clear to me what Israel should have done to fight Hamas. What is clear to me is that they can't live with Hamas, right? There's no conceivable two-state solution with Hamas in charge of Gaza or any other part of the Palestinian government. So what to do about that, right? You got Hamas now with hundreds of Israeli hostages and some American hostages in tunnels hiding under hospitals, and the clock is ticking. What do you do? Do you just let them keep your hostages they've shown an aptitude for keeping hostages for years and years at a stretch. They'll keep them for 5, 6, 7, 10 years. They're happy to wait you out playing that game. So what do? You've just had 1,200 of your civilians butchered. I think it's, again, say what you want about Netanyahu, it's very easy to see that any person in charge of the Israeli government at that point would have done something similar, right? I just do not know how different the policy would have been with the perfect person in charge of the Israeli government and the IDF at that point. It's a, you know, tactically and strategically, it's an impossible problem. You're fighting a death cult, a widely supported death cult, who is eager to see its own civilians destroyed. How do you fight that war and minimize the loss of human life so successfully that Theo Von never has to make a video about how there's a genocide in Gaza? There may be no adequate answer to that question. It may be impossible. Well, you may need, you know, perfect AI and perfect robots, you know, at some point in the future to do that. But what is clear is that you can't live with Hamas if you're Israel. You can't live with Hezbollah if you're Israel. You can't live with the Iranian regime if you're Israel. I think that it's just the writing is on the wall for all of that. And again, this is of a piece with a larger conflict between the West and open societies generally and jihadism. We can't live with jihadists, right? In our country, in other countries, waiting to perpetrate acts of terrorism. We can't self-censor our discussion of these things so fully that we're not going to have massacres in the streets of Paris at concerts or in the offices of journalists. All of this is coming. This is going to keep coming. It's going to keep happening because these people keep spreading their ideology. We have to win a war of ideas against this death cult behavior in the Muslim world. Again, it's not just Israel. It's not just the Middle East. This is in the streets of London and every other European capital. We have to win. Now, part of winning is just, a war of ideas, but part of winning is killing jihadists. And if you're Israel, that is absolutely clear in a way that we can't expect it to be clear to someone living in relative safety in right. the States or in Australia or in Canada at the moment.
Well, Andrew, I want to thank you for your question. I hope I did I did you some justice in representing it. It's not a position I actually hold, but I wanted to represent it as well as I could because I thought his email again was beautiful. And
it was very well done.
We're definitely over time for today, but I want to thank all of our subscribers who submitted questions. You can do that by going to Sam's Substack page. We'll put up a new post where you can drop your comments and questions before the next episode, so be on the lookout for that. Sam, thank you as always for doing this.
Yeah. Until next time.